Sir Day.
I think it's fair to say that everything I said yesterday is in one of these papers, either a very nice review by Dipson on the status of gauge theory amplitudes and so on in 96. He's a TASI lecture. In the original paper by Witten, where he describes or he introduces twister string theory, the review that you have the copy that I wrote with Peter Svercek, and a nice review by Nair, very recent review. Okay. So let me remind you, which one is our goal? Okay. So our goal is to somehow relate a topological string theory, which is a B model living on a super twister space plus ND5 frames plus D1 instantons and we would like to relate this to the perturbation theory of the maximally supersymmetric Jan-Mills theory. Okay. Well, today we will continue our way towards this. We will describe many of the things that one can do from twister space in perturbative super Jan-Mills theory, and then we will get to the topological string. Okay? Also, at the end of the lectures, I'll try to give you a list of the challenges that this description faces. So hopefully one of you will be able to solve them. Okay? So yesterday, we end the lecture by studying the conformal group. And we had the realization of the conformal group in terms of these spinners. And we found that it was a very strange representation, right? We had differential operators, first order differential operators, second order differential operators. Even the dilatation operator was not homogeneous. And we found that if we write the same generators in terms of these variables, okay? Where we introduce the conjugate to lambda tilde, which we call mu, we found that the conformal group has a nice representation in terms of linear operators. And that was a nice representation of SL4C, which has a nice action on C4 with coordinates zi, lambda 1, lambda 2, mu 1, and mu 2. And this was our twister. And this was our twister space. Okay, very good. Now, something that is going to be useful is the following. It's a description of this in 2,2 signature. Okay, and why is that? Well, because the whole story of the twister transform will have a nice interpretation as a Fourier transform. I told you yesterday that we can interpret this as a Fourier transform. But if these are complex variables, the meaning of that thing is complicated. And one has to introduce some heavy machinery that we don't have time to discuss. But instead, we can get a lot of information by going to 2,2 signature. Do you remember what is special about the spinners in 2,2 signature? They are real, right? So these guys are real. So this can actually be interpreted as a Fourier transform in two dimensions. Not only that, but also look at this. The conformal group in 2,2 signature is, well, remember that the Lorentz group was SO2,2. Now the conformal group simply becomes SO3,3, okay? which is isomorphic without any complexification to SL4R. Now, SL4R has a nice action on R4. So we don't have to work with C4. We have the real version, R4. And why is this going to be useful? Well, we can ask the following question. We now understand how the conformal group looked like in terms of the twister variables. But what about a given amplitude? Okay. Well, suppose that you take a given amplitude in terms of lambda i tilde, and the helicity of the gluons. So we can define the same amplitude in twister space by just doing a Fourier transform. That's why I want to work in this signature. Well, what would it be a Fourier transform? So we just do we introduce a conjugate variable for each spinner. So let me call this one J. Okay. And we integrate over the lambda tildes for each of them. And this thing is going to be a function of lambda j's, mu j's, and hj. So this will be our amplitude twister transform into twister space. Okay. Well, you would say, but so what? What do we do with that? Well, it turns out that this amplitude written in twister space will have very nice properties that are not very transparent in terms of the original amplitude. And that's why this is going to be useful. OK. But before we do that, remember that yesterday we said that these amplitudes are given in terms of the wave functions as multilinear functions in terms of the wave functions. Okay? And from the fact that these guys were multilinear functions in those guys, we concluded that these guys had some scaling. Property with respect to lambda and lambda tilde. Okay. If you take the lambda of a given gluon, this was equal to minus 2 times the helicity of that gluon. Okay. So that's a particular scaling that this amplitude has. Now, what about this equation in terms of twister space? If we make this replacement, what do you think we're going to get? Well, I hope you all did the homework and you found how the dilatation operator loses a 2, right? Likewise, we're going to gain a 2 here once we transform this. We get a plus sign because there is an I in the definition. Okay, so there is going to be a 2 here that is going to the other side. So I'm going to write it on the other side. Okay. Now, what do we learn from here? Well, if you look at this formula, this is precisely the scaling of this amplitude. Or it describes the scaling of this amplitude under a rescaling of all the twister variables, z going to t zi, where t belongs to c star. Well, this means that amplitudes in twister space are homogeneous functions of some degree determined by the helicity of the gluon. Okay? So the conclusion is that this amplitude has degree minus 2 hi minus 2, in the C4 that describes the ith gluon. So we have n copies of C4, and these amplitudes are homogeneous functions on each C4. Now, if these are homogeneous functions on C4, it is natural to introduce projective coordinates, or to interpret the zi's as projective coordinates. So we want to identify the zi's, and in the complex version, we end up with CP3, or in the real version, we end up with RP3. And our amplitudes would be exceptions of a line bundle over the corresponding copy of CP3 or RP3. Okay. Now let's look at the MHV amplitude again, which is actually the only amplitude we know how to compute at this point, right? So that's the only thing we can look at. And let's see how this amplitude looks like in twistor space. So we will perform the Fourier transform explicitly. And let's see what we get. Well, we have to perform integrations over each of these variables. This is a Fourier transform. Instead of writing this in terms of the inner products, but let me write it here in terms of the inner products, which is shorter. Then we have the MHV amplitude, which is basically given by the delta function of momentum conservation times our friend. So if this was the amplitude where gluons 1 all the way through I minus 1 have plus helicity, and then we have I minus helicity and so on up to J minus helicity and then N plus helicity. We have IJ here to the fourth, and then the product of all the other guys in the denominator. Okay. Well, here comes the important fact about MHV amplitudes. This whole function does not depend on lambda tilde. It only depends on lambdas. So it's a holomorphic function. Let me just call it f of lambda. Okay. Now, the Fourier transform acts only on the delta function. So in order to see clearly what is going to happen, let me write the delta function as an integral basically over space-time, okay, of e to the I xaa dot with a sum, okay? So we just have our delta function written in terms of an integral. All right, so let's pull out the integral in x from this whole thing. Right? And let's combine everything that depends on lambda tilde. We can also pull out f of lambda because it doesn't do anything. So we just want to collect everything that depends on lambda tilde. So I just rewrote this. But I have one factor that contains the ith coordinate in each part here of the delta function. So I can combine it into one thing by adding it here. Okay? And that's it. This is my whole formula. Now you surely recognize what this is, right? This is the expression of a delta function in two dimensions, right? So I have nothing else but a bunch of delta functions imposing the following vector has to vanish. Okay. Do you recognize this equation? This is the equation we got yesterday, right? So this precisely tells us that this amplitude, our MHB amplitude, vanishes unless the twistor coordinates of each of the gluons satisfy this equation. Okay? Well, let's see what this equation implies in plus, plus, minus, minus signature. There, we have a copy of R4, right? Now we can choose, well, we decided to make the projection by T, so we really have RP3. But if we choose, these were our homogeneous coordinates, okay? But if we divide by lambda 1, and we define y1 to be lambda 2 over lambda 1, y2 equal to mu 1 over y1, and y3 to be mu 2 over y1, we have a copy of R3. And these two equations define two planes, and the intersection of these two planes defines a line. Okay? We have two equations, right? So we conclude that our MHB amplitude is localized in twistor space on a line. It means that all gluons are supposed to be on a line, otherwise the amplitude vanishes. Well, that's very simple. That's a beautiful geometrical description of these amplitudes. This is like an extra constraint on the amplitudes, which was not completely clear from the description in space-time. Oh, well. Okay. Well, of course, if we do the same thing in CP3, what we find is that the gluons are localized on a CP1. Okay. Very good. Now, these two equations are two equations of degree 1, right? These are two polynomials of degree 1. Now, if you study a little bit of complex analysis and algebraic geometry on CP3, you will realize that this actually describes a holomorphic curve of genus 1, of genus 0, and degree 1. Okay? This can be generalized to curves of any degree if you have the following. If you have two polynomials, that's called f of z1. Let me call the coordinates zi, okay? So I'm tired of writing lambdas and mu's, so let's just call them z's. If you have two polynomials of the z variables of degree d1 and degree d2, these are homogeneous polynomials, okay? The solution set of these two polynomials gives you a holomorphic curve of degree d1 times d2, okay? So after you see that the MHB amplitudes do this, it at this point is, I can say that it's natural to conjecture, but if you don't know it, you have to be witten to conjecture this. But since we know the answer, we can say that it's natural to conjecture. that if you have an amplitude that has say Q gluons of minus helicity and P gluons of plus helicity, and if you are bold enough, you can actually go ahead and generalize from here and say that the amplitude you are computing is at the L loop level. Okay. Here we have been discussing three amplitudes of gluons. Now let's generalize the thing and say that this is L loops. Then the conjecture is that these amplitudes are localized in twisted space on holomorphic curves of degree Q minus 1 plus L and genus less or equal than L. Okay? Well, I'm not going to try to prove it now, but let's try to test this conjecture in the next case. How does? Very good. It does nothing. Do you see that here the localization doesn't depend on the number of P, right? Here we had only two minuses. Okay, that's very good. I should have said that here. So let's do the counting for the MHB amplitude. For the MHB amplitude, we have any P, and we have Q equals 2. Right? And we're working at three level, which means that L is equals to 0. So we get that the amplitude is supposed to be localized on a degree 1 curve of genus 0 for any P. Very good. If I choose what? Yes. Well, this is an excellent question. So if you see these two amplitudes, you say, well, they are related by an operation, right, in space-time. What's the operation? Parity. You perform a parity transformation, you go one from the other. You get one from the other one. Actually, I can tell you what the other one is immediately. If this one was, well, I erase it here. If this one was this, and we had plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, plus, I can write immediately this one by simply reversing, by replacing these brackets and getting these brackets. Now, your question is very good. What about the twister description of this guy? Well, when you look at the formula, it tells you that the degree is very high. This is supposed to be a very complicated curve. Indeed, it's a very complicated curve. And after you do all the algebra, and you spend, I don't know, how long it took for Bolovich, Spratling, and Radu, Roiban, yes, they actually were able to compute this and get this formula. Well, what's the reason behind this? Why is this description so complicated if the object is so simple? Well, the reason behind all this is here. Remember that we chose to do something funny to the lambda tildes, not to the lambdas, right? But we know that these amplitudes are parity invariant. I mean, that the theory is parity invariant. So all we have to do is to compute the amplitude using the simplest description, and then we use a parity transformation to get the other one. Okay.
Can I
Well, Witten wrote a 30-page paper with 30 heavy mathematics to prove that the two things were actually related by parity invariant. I invite you to read the paper. If you find it simple, then you can explain it to me. Okay. So what about amplitudes with more blue, with more minuses? Okay. Well, let's look at this one. I told you that these amplitudes were complicated objects in terms of both brackets, holomorphic and anti-holomorphic brackets. Then, what do you have to do in order to see the twisted space support? In principle, you have to do a Fourier transform of these objects. Well, that's a nightmare. It's very complicated. On the other hand, something else that you can do is to take the condition that the object is localized on some curve and translate that condition by the Fourier transform into differential operators in space-time. And if the amplitude is localized on a certain curve in twisted space, it will be annihilated by the corresponding differential operator in space-time. Well, that's the game we play for a while to test whether this guy was localized on a degree 2 curve, right? Because we're doing three-level amplitudes. So if we follow the prescription, it's supposed to be localized on a degree 2 curve. What did we find? We found a surprise. The thing does the following. It's localized on the intersection of two lines. Well, I don't know if I should draw all of them. Maybe. It seems to be given as a sum of terms localized in this form. For genetic kinematical invariants, yes. Oh, something that reminds me. In this equation, what we did for the MHV amplitude, remember that there was an integral over x, right? This x parametrizes a moduli space of curves in twisted space. So the amplitude is localized on curves, but these curves span the whole moduli space. In this case, we find the same thing. This intersection of two curves will span the whole moduli. So what we're finding here is that these guys are not localized on generic degree 2 curves, but on very singular degree 2 curves. Okay? Let's see if you can recognize something that happens to these guys. Okay. And then we have three more. Let me tell you what happens to the other ones. The other ones are exactly these three ones. But what you do is that you basically reflect one and three, meaning that one will be along here, and you will have two and three on this side. Okay? So basically, you move two here. But if you have only one gluon here, you have to move this guy here. Note that there are no lines with just a single gluon. Okay? So if you have two, three, then you will have necessarily a six here. Okay? Four here. Four can be here or here. And of course, if four is here, five has to be here. Okay? So we have three more configurations of this form. Can you see any pattern? Well, not quite, right? Okay. Well, look at the picture here. This is supposed to be twister space. So consider one of them. Let's take this one. Okay. And let's try to draw the same picture in space-time. Now, there is a point here, the intersection point. What does that correspond to if you look at that picture? So a point in twister space looks like a null ray, right? So this point looks like something propagating here. Now, a line in twister space corresponds to what? Corresponds to a point, right? So this guy corresponds to a point here. And this guy corresponds to a point here. So we find something like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. OK? Well, if this is a kind of a gluon propagating here, we know that for this to be an MHB amplitude, or to be something that doesn't vanish, we have to assign to this particle, to this hypothetical particle, we have to assign what helicity for this to be an amplitude that is non-zero. We have plus, 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 minus. So this guy, this hypothetical particle, must have minus helicity, right? So if everybody's outgoing and you have a minus helicity particle outgoing, is a minus helicity particle ingoing here, right? Which means that it's a plus helicity particle outgoing. So now you see that the idea is that each of these vertices become an MHV amplitude. So the intersection points are such that on one side, it looked like a minus helicity particle, and on the other side, it looks like a plus helicity particle. In these cases, we need the plus on this side and the minus on this side. OK. Now, if you look at that, this looks like a crazy picture, right? And why is that? Well, because Jan Mills doesn't have 5-point vertices. And this is a 5-point vertex. So what are we talking about? Well, we must be talking about a new diagrammatic expansion. Of Jan Mills, in which we are resumming Feynman diagrams in a funny way, and where vertices are MHB amplitudes and there is some sort of propagator which we still have to determine. We will see. Okay. Okay. Let's try to answer that question by writing what the contribution of this diagram would be. So we will have this amplitude on the left is the amplitude with 1 minus, 2 minus, and this hypothetical particle with momentum plus. On the other side, we have our friend with helicity minus, 3 minus, 4 plus, 5 plus, 6 plus. Now, if you look at the MHV amplitudes, you can see immediately what the dimension of an amplitude without the delta function has to be. The dimension of this whole thing has to be 4 minus the number of gluons In this case, there are 6 gluons, so the dimension has to be 4 minus 6 equals minus 2, right? Let's see the dimension of each of these guys by itself. So we have 4 minus 3, we have 1, and here we have 4 minus 5, we have minus 1. So we are missing something that must have dimension minus 2. This amplitude already have the correct scaling under lambda going to some t lambda, and lambda tilde going to some t lambda tilde for each of the gluons. So this thing appearing here has to be invariant under those rescalings. And there is nothing else I can think of but just to write 1 over p squared, where p is the momentum going from one of these on one of these sides, from one of these sides, either p1 plus p2, or by momentum conservation, the sum of these momenta going in this direction. But now we face your question, right? This guy is not a null vector, right? So p squared is not 0, luckily. Otherwise, this would be a mess, OK? But p hat squared has to be 0. How do we define p hat? What is p hat? Well, yesterday, I told you that any vector can be written as a bispinor. And moreover, it can be written as a sum of these two combinations of spinors, right? Now, let me just say that p hat is going to be a piece of this. Clearly, this was our definition of a null vector, right? A null vector is something that can be written as a product of just two spinors. But in these formulas, I need the lambda of p hat, OK? How can I get this object out of here? I don't even know what these guys are. Well, let's try the following. Let me contract PAA dot with lambda tilde prime of A dot. What do I get? So I'm summing over these indices here. So I get on this side lambda A, which is the one I want to compute. This is the lambda of the p hat. I get the bracket of lambda tilde prime, plus lambda A prime, the bracket of lambda tilde prime. But what is this? This is 0. OK? So I'm very close to finding my lambda p. I just have to divide by this. OK? And now you have all the right to say that I've done the most stupid thing that one can do, right? Which is to express something in terms of things that you don't know, right? Well, it's true that that's the case there. But let me tell you why this trick works. First of all, if we write that formula explicitly for the amplitude, we get 1, 2 cubed. Remember, we have to the power 4, but it will cancel with 1 power in the denominator. So we have this p hat here, p hat 1. We have the propagator. And now the p hat appears in the numerator combined with 3 to the third power. Then p hat goes with, let's see if we go, we're going in which direction? We're going 1, 2. Then we go 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, and 6 p hat. OK? What's the degree of this formula in p hat? Well, I hope it's 0. There are 3 powers in the denominator and 3 powers in the numerator, right? So do I ever have to define what I mean by this? No, it drops out, OK? So I'll simply say that lambda p hat is defined as p a a dot. Now, this notation is too complicated, so I'll just call this eta. Okay? And define the contribution of my MHP diagram. That's the way we call them, MHP diagrams. Just as a contraction of P with a reference spinner, fixed, but arbitrary. Okay? Very good. So that's what I mean by that diagram. Now, the claim is that if you sum the six diagrams I showed you before with this prescription, that is very easy to just write down, then you get the correct amplitude. If you remember, yesterday I told you that this amplitude was a very complicated object. Okay? Well, it was a complicated object, but this one was even more complicated. Right? Well, before we do this, what will happen if we have an amplitude that has one more minus? Suppose that instead of three, we have four minuses. What does Witten's formula tell us about the degree of the curve? If we have to have degree three, right? At three level, if we have degree three. So if this pattern continues, it will have to be something that has three lines intersecting, okay? And that's what we found, that this thing, if you have four minuses and a bunch of pluses, you find three lines intersecting. If you have one more minus and a bunch of pluses, then you have four lines intersecting. Now, in this case, you can have things that look like this, right? So you can play all kind of games and check that the thing actually works. Now, if you look at this amplitude, what's going to happen? Well, this amplitude only has three minuses as our previous example. So it will have to be equal to the sum of terms that only involve two MHP vertices, okay? The three minuses cannot be on the same vertex. Why? Because that would not be MHP, right? None of the two sides would be MHP. So we have to have one here, two, three, okay? And then we can have n here, and any number of gluons here, let's call it I, up to here, I plus one, and we sum over I, plus the sum over I again of the other class of vertices, which we have one and two, three along, and then four plus all the way to I, n plus, and I plus one plus, okay? Now, if you want to tell your friends that you have computed an infinite series of non-MHP amplitudes, all you have to do is to use this formula, this prescription I told you, and apply it to every term in this expansion and write the formula. Okay. Of course, I can tell you whatever I want. The question is this correct? I get a formula. Is this formula the correct amplitude that you compute, as I told you? If you have six gluons here, you have to add up, say, 200,000 Feynman diagrams. Is this thing actually giving you the correct answer? Well, the key idea is that all these amplitudes are rational functions. in lambda and lambda tilde. Now, if you work in complexified, if you complexify the Lorentz group and you work with complex momenta, each of these guys are independent complex variables, okay? And then, if you have a function of some number of complex variables, and it's a rational function, and you can prove that this function has the correct singularities, which are only poles, okay, then the amplitude or the object is completely determined. So what we have to do is to prove that these guys actually have the correct pole structure that the Feynman diagram would have, okay? And that can be done. We're not going to do it here. You can do it as an exercise. But we will try to do something that is simpler that will lead us to the same conclusion later today. So the idea is to check. One can check that MHB diagrams produce correct singularities. Okay? Well, they produce the correct singularities of these guys, but you also have to ask the question, well, are there more singularities that these guys have that these ones don't have? Well, one candidate for such a thing would be these weird things in the denominator, say, p-sits. This is a pole, okay? It's a weird pole. It cannot be a propagating particle or anything. Well, it has something even worse. Since eta is fixed, the location of this pole is not Lorentz invariant. Okay? Well, something one can prove is that the sum of all MHB diagrams is eta independent. And then one can restore Lorentz invariance. Well, if you restore Lorentz invariance, that immediately implies that all these poles are spurious. Which means that they are not there, right? They have zero residue. And that basically proves that these diagrams give the correct field theory amplitudes. Now, what would be the next step? Well, it seems that we have under control three-level amplitudes of gluons, right? We can write any three-level amplitude in terms of MHB diagrams, compute each MHB diagram very easily, and then we get the answer. What would be your next question? Oh, yeah. I wish I knew. Yes. Well, there was a work by a group at Harvard where they proved that even if you start with connected with honest degree D curves, when you integrate over the whole moduli space, the integral that you have to do localizes at the boundaries of the moduli space. So these actual degree two curves localize to this intersection of curves. So it's just a fact that happens. We don't understand why. I mean, if you want the real mean, the reason for that, we don't know. It just, you can prove that the things localize to the boundaries of the moduli space. Because as I told you, you have to integrate over the whole moduli space of the curves. Yes? Excellent. That's the next question. Very good. Very good. What about loops? Well, the answer is yes, there is something, which is not very well understood, but there is something. Okay, but here we come to the question we asked yesterday, right? At this, up to now, I didn't even tell you that we were doing n equals 4 super jump mills. The reason is that, as I told you yesterday, at tree level, amplitudes of gluons at, for n equals 4 super jump mills and for pure jump mills are exactly the same. Does anybody know why? What? Yes, there is no diagram that you can write that has. That's right, but very good. That's the basic reason. So let me tell you, n equals 4 super jump mills. So today, you saw or you learned the basic representations of n equals 1 super jump mills, right? So people usually call them W alpha and phi, okay? This guy is the one that has the vector boson and the chiral fermion and the Weyl fermion. And this one is the one that has the complex scalar and the fermion, okay? Now, n equals 4 super jump mills is just the same thing, repeated several times, okay? This guy is repeated several times. So n equals 4 super jump mills has one of these guys and three of these guys. Okay, so I like to write it in this case as a gluon plus four fermions plus three complex scalars. Okay, well, there is something else that probably you're going to learn in the supersymmetry lectures, which is that there is a global symmetry that acts on these things. It's called an R symmetry. In the case of n equals 4 super jump mills, the R symmetry is SU4. Okay. And each of these particles transform in different ways under the SU4 R symmetry. The scalars transform in the sets of SU4. The fermions transform either in the 4 or the 4 bar. And the gluons are just scalars, okay? Now, if you have a conserved symmetry, right, and you have an amplitude, okay, and you have two guys that transform under the one of the group, there is no way you can produce a 4 or a 4 bar or a 6, okay? So that's a way to prove that there is no way to write any diagram that would contain these guys, or at least only one of them. So there is no way to write this kind of vertex, even for a complex scalar emanating from here. Okay. But this formula will also teach us something interesting. In the real world, at the LHC, we will have to compute amplitudes where we have a gluon running in the loop. Okay. Well, let me write this gluon as a gluon plus four fermions plus three scalars. Okay. Well, this is not an inequality, of course. But what about if I subtract four of these guys? It's almost an equality. What else do we have to do? At one scalar. Now it's an equality, I hope. If it's not, let me know. Okay, so here we have, in terms of this, these are particles running in the loop. So we have that the QCD amplitude is equal to the n equals 4 amplitude, which we want to compute now, minus 4 times an n equals 1 amplitude where a chiral multiplet is running in the loop, plus an amplitude where a scalar is running in the loop, okay? Now, believe me that the scalar running in the loop is a much simpler problem than a gluon running in the loop. Yes? Well, all these guys are in the adjoint representation. So these guys actually don't couple to the U1. That's very, I forgot to say that all these guys are in the joint representation. They have to be in the same representation if you're going to have supersymmetry, something that relates all of them. OK, but let's go back to the question. What about loops? Now we restrict ourselves to n equals 4 superjambians. OK, this theory is very special. Well, what does our formula predict for these guys? MHV amplitudes. So we have Q equals 2 minus 1 plus 1 is equal to 2, and G less or equal than 1. OK? Well, here again, you find a surprise, right? Because your genus 1 curve, a nice genus 1 curve, doesn't show up. For some reason, it's not there. All you find are just two lines which seem to be connected by propagators in twisted space. This picture, I have to say, or I have to confess, it's not very well understood. There are some divergences that are not well understood. The propagators blow up at funny points. So this is an open problem to define this very properly. So one problem for you guys. But something that people did is the following. Forget about the twister description, how to compute the thing in twister space. Let's just do the naive thing. Take an MHV vertex, another MHV vertex, minus, minus, plus, plus, and so on. OK? And just connect the thing with two propagators. Let's call the momentum flowing in this propagator L. The momentum flowing in this propagator would be P minus L, where P, let's call it P left, is the momentum incoming from the left. Let's call this I, okay? And this one I plus 1. Then integrate over L, sum over I. And now comes the part where n equals 4 supersymmetry is important. You have to sum over all particles that can run in the loop. So the full n equals 4 supermultiplet will run in the loop. OK? Or well, sometimes only gluons will be allowed to run in the loop. But sometimes the full n equals 4 multiplet will be allowed. Now, for this to be an MHV amplitude, you have two negative helicity gluons. So you have to assign to these guys plus helicity and to these guys minus helicity. Of course, again, you have to give the meaning of L hat. When you see the lambda of L hat entering here, you have to tell me what it is. And you can guess what I'm going to choose to be. It's going to be L AA dot, eta A dot, right? And I'm going to choose the lambda of this guy. To be P minus L, A dot, eta A dot. Now, these amplitudes, n equals 4 superjambians, has a nice property, which is that it's finite in the UV, in the ultraviolet. It doesn't have UV divergences. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't have divergences, because we also have to worry about the infrared. And these amplitudes will have infrared divergences, and we have to regulate them somehow. And one natural choice is dimensional regularization, where epsilon, we take it now to be less than 0. usually we choose it to be larger than zero, but that's in the case when you have UV divergences. Okay. Well, does this work? These amplitudes were computed in 94, okay, using field theory techniques. And this integration was done last year by a group in England, Brankhuber et al. And they found a precise agreement between this formula and the formula you get from a standard field theory method. So that's a great success of this formula. Now, the natural question is, does this work for non-MHV one-loop amplitudes? Well, this is, again, an exercise for you. Okay, nobody has done it, so this is an open problem. Okay, I hope some of you tried the exercise I gave you yesterday, that was to show that this diagram reduces, or the color structure of this diagram reduces to a single loop in color space plus permutations. I'm sure all of you did it, right? So that was under control. What about one loop? Well, it turns out that at one loop, the story is just slightly more complicated. And you can show through the same exercise that the one loop amplitude, the full thing, is given in terms of single trace terms . So we have to give different names to this, maybe A, curly A, and this one A, plus terms that involve two traces. Times this A. Well, there is a name for these guys. Well, there is nothing else. There are no three traces. This is just the end of the story. So these are called leading color . If you want the full name, it will be leading color, color order, partial amplitudes. As I did yesterday, I will never repeat this name again. I will just say the amplitude we are computing, right? So when we did this, we were talking about just this amplitude, okay? So this is what we were doing. You would say, well, but then we haven't computed the whole thing. There is also this piece. Well, there is an amazing result that tells you that this guy is giving us a linear combination of permutations of these guys. Okay? So if you compute these ones, you get the answer for the full amplitude. That's why this is useful. Okay. So if you solve this problem and you carry out the calculation, can you compare the answer to something that is known? So let me tell you what is known about one loop amplitudes. Okay. Well, something that was found in the 90s is that any amplitude in n equals 4 supergermials has an amazing property. They are very, very simple in a sense. When you take all the Feynman diagrams, the millions of Feynman diagrams that have a very complicated tensor structure in the numerator and so on, and you apply something that is called the Passarino-Veltmann reduction, which basically means that whenever you have a power of momentum in the numerator, you write it in terms of linear combinations of propagators in the denominator. When you carry out that a huge number of times, all these complicated integrals will just become scalar integrals. I'm going to tell you what they are in a minute. So let me just write that statement as follows. Where this is what is known as a scalar box integrand, and the reason it's called a scalar is because it's a one loop integrand that has a 1 in the numerator. That's why it's a scalar integral. And the propagators are exactly what you're thinking they are. OK. Well, these integrals, they also have the divergence, the infrared divergence, so they have to be regulated somehow. Okay. But what is nice about these integrals is that they are completely known. Okay. They are completely known in terms of die logarithms and logarithms. Okay. Very good. What about these coefficients? Well, these coefficients turn out to be rational functions of the spin or inner products of the external particles. OK. Well, of course, if we knew the coefficients, we would know the amplitude, right? So the problem is actually to compute these coefficients. What are those coefficients? What our friends did in this case was to show that this sum actually reproduces the correct sum over scalar box integrals with the correct coefficients. In this case, believe it or not, all the coefficients are either 0 or the 3-level amplitude. That's all. 0 or just a 3-level amplitude, the Park-Taylor simple amplitudes. Well, then, when you look at such a simple result, the next thing to do is to try the net amplitude, right? So you try the amplitude with 3 minuses and 3 pluses. And what you find is, again, a mess. In 94, that amplitude was computed, and it was a complicated thing. All the coefficients were complicated things with no structure. They were very complicated functions of these two guys. Well, but now we know a trick to compute these coefficients. and it's the following. Each of these scalar functions, they have a natural singularity. Which is unique to each of the boxes. Okay? So the basic idea is the following. As you know, or as you're familiar with in quantum field theory, a given loop amplitude usually has branch caps. So one can compute the discontinuity across the branch cap. By doing something that is called a unitarity cut, which means you take all Feynman diagrams in the amplitude that share two given propagators, and you cut the two propagators. Well, usually people write this as the imaginary part of the thing. But the imaginary part is really the discontinuity across a branch cut. Okay. Now, cutting a propagator means the following. If you have a Feynman propagator, okay, you have the principal part of the propagator plus a delta function. Okay. So cutting the propagator means actually cutting a piece of it and just leaving the delta function that imposes a condition that the momentum of that particle is on-shell. So when you do that, these two particles become on-shell, and these are two three-level amplitudes. Well, clearly, one of these cuts is shared by many boxes. So that is not the singularity we're looking for. A branch cut is a singularity, but it's not the one we're looking for. It turns out that the unique singularity is obtained by cutting all propagators, meaning doing a quadruple cut. So if you have a given box and you cut all four propagators, it's clear that only one of them, one of the boxes, will have the given four propagators, because by definition, the sum is over inequivalent boxes. Now, if you combine all Feynman diagrams, the millions of Feynman diagrams that will share the same four propagators, you will have a similar thing here. And this is a coefficient we would like to compute. This is M. Okay? And we are cutting the four propagators, which means that we are putting all these particles on shell. Therefore, this is a product of four three-level amplitudes. OK, so we are cutting the four propagators. We are getting four delta functions. So we are getting four equations for a vector L, which is a momentum that is running in the loop, right? So this is a four vector. So this is one of the nice things about this. In n equals 4 super young mills, only boxes enter. The boxes only have four propagators. When you cut all of them, you get four equations. And we're working in four dimensions. Therefore, you have a four vector and four equations. That means that the integral is completely localized. You can completely determine the loop momentum by the four conditions that you're imposing. We are cutting all four propagators. Therefore, we have to find an L that satisfies these conditions. Let me call S the set of all possible solutions. where the k's are, of course, the sum of these momenta. Okay. Well, can anyone tell me how many solutions are there? Well, that's a very good guess, two. Well, actually, in four dimensions, but I have to tell you something else before you can guess the answer. I have to tell you the signature of the space-time. Suppose that we're working in Minkowski signature. Can you tell me how many solutions there are? Well, the answer is none. There are no solutions to this guy, to this set of equations in Minkowski space for real momentum. So the trick is, of course, to complexify L and everybody. Something else that we can do is just to weak rotate this integral and everything that we're doing into 2,2 signature. If we do this, even for real momentum, we still have enough freedom to solve these equations. And in fact, if you do one of these two things, the number of solutions is exactly 2, as somebody just guessed or computed. I don't know. In any case, once we do this, we find that the solution is a complex L. Okay? Well, but it doesn't matter. Once we do it, as I told you, the integrals that you get on one side that has the 4 delta functions and the product of the 4 three-level amplitudes, where this is 1, 2, 3, and 4, okay? On the other side will be the coefficient times the integral with the 4 delta functions, okay? So I told you that this integral localizes, and it produces, on this side, 2 times a Jacobian. On this side, each solution will produce a different set of amplitudes. So we have to sum over the set of amplitudes, over the set of solutions, okay? The Jacobian is the same for any of the solutions. And we get the product of the 4 three-level amplitudes. Okay. Of course, we have to remember to sum over the full n equals 4 supermultiplet. So there is also sum over all the particles that can run with different helicities. Now, if you look at this equation, we can just cancel out the Jacobian. I don't even have to tell you what it is. And we find that our coefficient is just given by 1/2 the product of 4 three-level amplitudes. So this is a formula that allows you to compute any coefficient for any amplitude with any number of gluons and any helicity configuration. All you have to do is to compute three-level amplitudes where these guys are part of the three-level amplitude. Okay, but they are evaluated at these solutions, so they are on shell. So these are physical three-level amplitudes. The only thing that is a little bit funny is that this L, when you find the solution to these equations, even though it's a null vector, the following happens. After you impose that all the external momenta are again physical and on shell, lambda a dot tilde is not lambda bar of a. Okay? This guy never makes it back to real momentum in Minkowski space. But who cares? This is an internal guy. Nobody, it doesn't have a physical meaning. So it doesn't really matter that this guy never makes it back to a real momentum. All it matters is that in the end, this is a formula that is again given in terms of the inner products of the external particles, and all of them can be taken to be real in Minkowski space. Wow, yeah. You guys are very good, because what I was going to write was your next assignment, which is to find a picture or an interpretation of that formula in Twistor space. Or better yet, a derivation of this from Twistor space. Okay? So I guess the answer to the question I asked you before, which was, what is known about one loop amplitudes in n equals 4? The answer to it is everything, because we can reduce the problem to a three-level computation. Okay? Very good. So this is still a challenge for Twistor space or for Twistor string theory. So we have 15 minutes. Well, now we have 5 minutes. Okay, so in 5 minutes we will do 2 loops, 3 loops, and all loops. Okay. So what I'm going to describe now is a conjecture that was made by Anastasio, Bern, Dietzen, and Kossauer in 2003. But I believe it's the right time to look at the conjecture and try to actually prove it, because we now have lots of new techniques. Maybe Twistor space will help. So let me tell you what the ABDK conjecture is. So the conjecture states basically the following. Define a nicely normalized L loop amplitude as follows. Take the L loop amplitude and divide it by the 3-level amplitude. Okay? Remember that this guy depends on the dimensional regularization parameter. Right? Well, the conjecture says that ML is given in terms of a polynomial of M1 up to MN L minus 1. This is an amazing result. You would say, well, if this is true, in the end, everything is just given in terms of the one loop guy, right? Well, the thing is that I'm gonna tell you why I wrote it like this, just in a second. Let's write the explicit polynomial for 2 loops, which is known. It's given as 1/2 This is a funny thing. This guy is evaluated at a slightly different dimension. Okay. Where this F is given by this, and psi is the digamma function, which is nothing but the logarithmic derivative of the gamma function. Okay. Well, this is valid only up to order epsilon. It manifestly, it has been proven to disagree to order epsilon. Okay. So this is why we cannot use this formula to completely iterate this. The reason is that for three loops, you need the two loop guy, right? But evaluated to order epsilon. So it's not completely given in terms of the one loop guy. The reason you need to order epsilon is because you have this epsilon here, or you also have the infrared divergences that are given in terms of poles in epsilon. So the poles in epsilon in this guy, when it's square, will pick higher epsilon corrections to the other guys. Okay. In any case, just at this level, this is an amazing conjecture, right? Well, suppose that you can prove that conjecture. The conjecture has been proven explicitly for only four gluons. So the amplitude has been computed and has been shown to have that structure. Like 3 weeks ago, the three-loop four-gluon amplitude calculation was completed and was shown to have a similar structure in terms of a polynomial of the two-loop amplitude and the one-loop amplitude. Now, suppose that that continues and you are able to compute the structure of these polynomials, right? Well, imagine that you can resum the whole series, or you have a control on the whole series, okay? So we're doing n equals 4 super gem mills. So you do that, maybe just some wishful thinking here, you complete the whole sum, you resum the whole thing, so you get a formula that is valid for all couplings. Well, you can crank up the coupling, right? And if you do that, what should you see? We're doing n equals 4 super gem mills. Well, yesterday I told you that the first realization of a Hooft idea took 23 years, right? And what was it? The Maldacena conjecture, right? Relating n equals 4 super gem mills to string theory. So it is conceivable that it might be possible to see a classical geometry, an ADS5 process 5 geometry, somehow emerging from perturbation theory of n equals 4 super gem mills. Okay? So that's your next homework. Okay, so on my next lecture is not going to be on Friday, it's going to be on Saturday. So there was a rescheduling. I don't remember the time. It's going to be, I think, at 2:15 or something like that. And that lecture will entirely be dedicated to twister string theory, okay? So that would be the idea. We will discuss twister string theory, and then you will have the tools to start your projects on proving all these and all the things we have discussed.